Atta boy. Yeah, that's right. We're going to ride farther and faster than the normal ride. Oh, yeah, boy. You're ready. Saddle is on and cinched up tight. Stick that head over here and let me get that bit in your mouth. Now the bridle's on. We have a special ride today, Lightning. It's a super stud cast day. Time to give our fans the very best. And we're going to climb a couple of wrestling mountains and ride into history.
Yeehaw!
Part two of the tremendous 3 hour plus Super Studcast number 27 is again joined by the legendary Jerry Briscoe. It takes up where part one left off and is quite possibly the best Super Studcast yet. These two brothers of Native American birth have a unique history in one of America's most unique sports, professional wrestling. This fantastic ride into the lives of the success of the Briscoes, one a former NWA world champion and the other's career still going from territory days to the present day WWE. This Super Studcast goes deep into what the sport is all about. Wrestling fans worldwide will talk about this one for years. Jerry Briscoe finishes part two with the same honesty and openness that fascinated everyone in part one. You may never hear more true old school history than in the 3+ hours recorded here. Saddle up for this one of a kind history making podcast.
Hello again, friends and patrons of the Studcast, and welcome back for another Super Studcast. This one, a rematch. We have two all-time greats on the line once again, and we're going to continue where we left off on the previous edition. I'm the great Brian Last, and without any further ado, let me introduce to you the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Brian. Really glad to be here. We're really lucky, man. We had a great guest last time, and geez, he drove people crazy all over the world. I mean, the comments had just been spectacular, and really got back in touch with him, and he was really kind enough to say he would come back and do this second part with us. And there's a lot of questions that I didn't get to with him last time, and we really didn't get into his brother Jack, and I want to ask him some about Eddie Graham. We're really thankful to have him back on again. One of the most knowledgeable guys in the sport, obviously, and has had a tremendous career. He started back when in 1970, and he's still at it, you know, and he's worked his way through company after company and all the way into the WWE at this point. And it's just a real honor to have you and a pleasure to have you back on again, Jerry.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Ronald. I appreciate you bringing me onto the Studcast here. I enjoy talking to somebody with the knowledge that you have and preparation that you did to have your guest on. Sometimes you go on these podcasts and the guys are prepared and really doesn't have a guideline where to go. But when the Studcast comes on, you know you have a direction to go. And I appreciate that. And people who talk to you and become guest on the podcast, appreciate the direction and your fine producer Brian put together a game plan for us to follow, and it's tremendous. I enjoy talking to a buddy that has more wrestling history than just about anybody I know.
Well, I appreciate that very much, and I can't say enough about your family and what you and your brother accomplished. And so I want to start the day, Jerry, and I want to take it back. I usually ask a question to most of my people that I have on that I didn't actually get to last time, and it's pretty simple stuff, you know. I mean, it's like, where's your favorite place to work? The places that you work, where did you really like to work?
I started out in Oklahoma. I got out of Oklahoma State University in 1968, late 68, starting this year 69. And I started there. I was very fortunate because, my brother Jack, we're going to get to him a little bit, but he started the business several years before I did. And so I had an in. So during the summertime, like a lot of family members and brothers and everything, I called it an honor, and I got to drive the ring truck around and set up the ring and get to know the guys and actually sold the tickets and set up the chairs, made the payoff, separated the money and made the payouts and all this stuff and everything. So I started there in Oklahoma, Louisiana, Texas, Arkansas, and all that area. When I was basically finishing up my wrestling career at Oklahoma State. And then when I got out of school, what am I going to do? I wanted to be a wrestling coach in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. I had a good little program starting up there, and I wanted to, it wasn't too far from my hometown, my friend. So I looked into doing it, getting a job teaching and coaching wrestling. And my brother called, and of course, my mother didn't want me to, but my mother called, and I'd made that summer twice the amount of money, working, driving the ring and filling in for guys. And I got in the ring, my first match without any basic training whatsoever, except for like 13 years of amateur wrestling, and Buddy Colt had enough nerve and patience with me to go out, and we went 20 minutes my first match with Buddy Colt. And back in those days, as you know, there weren't many guys on the card. Then I came back in a tag match. My brother and I went against Buddy Colt and Danny Jack Donovan. That was basically my first experience. So during that summer, I'd made a lot of money, and not, a lot of money for me. It was a lot of money for me back in those days. And so I started looking at the comparison of coaching and teaching, and getting into professional wrestling. And of course, I'd made more money that summer driving a truck and for the wrestling company and filling in and refereeing and taking matches when guys were hurt. And I made more money that summer than I was going to, twice the money that I was going to make for teaching and coaching. So wasn't a very difficult decision. I had some convincing to do with Mom, of course. And after my brother and I convinced her that it was the right thing for me to do, I came down to Florida, and I think that's actually when I met you, and either 69 or early 69 or late 69, but somewhere around in there. And I just started in the business, worked down here for several weeks, and went through a little program with Dale Lewis. My actual first program in the business, I was basically a rookie, where he had that Lewis lock, famous Lewis lock. He put it on you, and people would tap out. And I was fortunate enough to, Gordon Soley doing the match call, and doing a job like that. What a lot of guys don't understand, sometimes you could do what we call it doing a job, getting beat, and get over better than you do it if you're winning the match. And of course, I didn't win the match because I was leaving, going to Japan. But Lewis put that Lewis lock on me. Jack was supposed to be there to wrestle me at a big Florida title challenge coming up. And so he was blasting my brother. So, being young and dumb, I went out and challenged Lewis and, step above my pay scale at that time. And so he put the Lewis lock on me, but I wouldn't give up. That was part of the deal. And then, of course, Gordon Soley kept saying, how my Native American heritage wouldn't allow me to give up and never give up, and kept going. Then all of a sudden, just as I was getting ready to black out from the pain, the airlines arrived and delivered my brother right at 106 North Albany Sportatorium there. And Jack made a run in with a suitcase and everything in hand, and of course beat off the evil Dale Lewis and saved my arm from being broken, saved my career. But the call from Gordon Soley is what really elevated me throughout the rest of my career here in Florida.
Oh, I'm telling you, he was fantastic. I think he was one of the best, if not the best ever. And he had a way of getting everybody over, man, if he wanted to. And that sounds like a heck of a finish there, man. That's typical Florida stuff, good stuff. And two amateurs. Dale was a tremendous amateur, too.
Dale was national champion at Oklahoma University, and we're Oklahoma State University, so we're real familiar with each other.
Oh, hell yeah. Natural rivalry right there, Yeah, so Florida was a good area for you. How long were you there? I don't remember exactly, Jerry. Was you there a period of time early in late 69? I started there about 1970.
Yeah, Ron, I was there. Like I said, I came in for it was agreed upon time because I was going to Japan, and that worked right into the old school gimmick. When you went to Japan, because there was no internet, no really communication from across the sea, so you could disappear and nobody really knew where the heck you went to. So we worked that angle. And of course, you know, the storyline was the Elos put me out of wrestling, you know, for good and all that stuff. So I went to did my 6 weeks in Japan. After Japan, I came back, and Bill Watts had just taken over the Oklahoma territory, and it was doing pretty decent. And I stopped in there for like 3 months. And while I was in Japan, I was fortunate enough that Jim Barnett made a trip over there, happened to see me, and he liked me because I was real young, right out of school. I was about 23. He invited me to come to Australia, so I had some time to fill. So I went to work with one of the most brilliant guys, I think, in the wrestling business at the time, Cowboy Bill Watts. And I was there at home for like 6 weeks before I went over to Australia to work with Jim. And originally, I just signed to go over there for 3 months was the ordinary tour. But I went over there, and like I said, Jim liked me, and I was very fortunate. It was Killer Carl Cox over there, Rip Hawk, Swede Hansen, Mark Lewin, King Curtis, one of the Graham, Crazy Luke Graham, and Lord Athol Layton. And I ended up staying an entire year in Australia for Jim working.
Wow.
And so I, of course, fell in love over there. You know, you promoted, you bought the territory, I believe, and I ended up promoting over there. So you know what I'm talking about. It was a great country to be in, great country for the boys. Jim had national TV at the time, the only company in Australia that had a national TV program. So we got to travel the entire continent of Australia, and it was a blast for a year.
I love working there. I was going to be there 3 months, and it was about the same time that Jack was going to win the title. And, you know, the deal happened with Junior, and I ended up getting sent back to Florida after 2 months. But I would have loved to have stayed there a year. You may have stayed there longer than anybody, man, at one stretch.
I think I was close to the record. Gary Hart stayed there. I think he was there longer than I was. But Jim, he helped Jim, you know, with the bookings and things like that. And Jim took a liking to me. And I was very fortunate. He started teaching me the business instead of just the working part of it. He said, Gerald, you're going to end up in an office somewhere. He knew that. I don't know how he knew it, but he knew it right off the bat, you know. And he started kind of grooming me for office work at that time there. And I, you know, here I was a rookie, and I'm sitting with the Madison Square Garden, Dominic Minucci, guys that sold out Madison Square Garden. I'm sitting there in a locker room with these guys, helping throwing things out for finishes and stuff like that. And I didn't even know what the hell I was talking about, but it must have worked. Cause, like I said, I stayed there for over a year, and that helped Jim out a lot.
Good Jim Barnett. I mean, gosh, you know, everybody
That's
has
a classic
opinion
name,
to
right?
Jim. Yeah, I mean, everybody has an opinion of Jim, but he was one of the brightest guys in the business, in the history of the business. You know, I think a pivotal character in all of wrestling, maybe Jim Barnett started Ray.
Well, you go back
on
Jim Barnett's history, Ron, and I mean, there's several occasions, you know, that's with the Sinclair Group. He started one of the first nationwide TV syndications, you know, out of Chicago, and had national TV back in the 50s before people ever thought about doing this stuff, you know. So he was quite an innovator, quite a character, you know, lived a glamorous lifestyle, and Jim was always dressed to the max and always was very professional around me and around people that I respected and everything. I got nothing but good things to say about Jim Barnett.
Same here, man. And you know, and like you said, he had a lot of class. He was a good model for the business, and really, really ran good businesses, good territories, had a lot of success. I want to take you back, man. I don't know if you even remember this, but sometime in 1973 or 74, the only trip I ever made with you is we were in St. Louis wrestling on a Friday, and we had to stay over and do the TVs, I guess, on Sunday.
Right.
And it was the only time in about the 2 years, off and on 2 years, I was in St. Louis that I ever got booked on a Saturday. And it was you and I. And it was somewhere in Illinois.
Waxley.
And we, Yeah, you
that was the name of it, Waxley, Illinois. I remember.
I'll be darned, man. And do you remember who we worked with?
No, I don't.
All right. We worked with Hans Schmidt and Big Bill Miller.
And, wow.
Yeah, wow. That's right. I mean, when people ask me who was the guy you least liked to work with in the business, I think I had to. Hans Schmidt's always been the first name out of my mouth. I mean, and that night we did kind of what you talked about just a second ago, doing an opening match and then coming back in a tag. I had the 20-minute Broadway opener with Hans Schmidt, and then me and you went back and worked a 2 out of 3 fall match, tag match with him.
Well, I'm glad you had the opener with Hans and not me.
It's crazy, man. We go back a heck of a long way. It's amazing how long we've been in the business, and especially you. You managed to be in it. I left and did some hockey and got eventually into ADT, and I've done a lot of different things, but you've stayed with it, man. And that's a tribute to you, man.
Well, you had talent outside the business, obviously.
You were
a great businessman, Ron. I mean, you know, like I discussed earlier, you started the hockey leagues. You started so many different promotions, and you took chances that ordinary guys wouldn't take. But because you had the smarts between your ears and the know-how and the gumption to go out and do it, and that's what I always respect about you.
Well, I appreciate that, man. You know, I guess you do sometimes. I got in over my head a couple of times, and I had to figure it out how the hell to do it. But
and you have to, and you did.
Yeah, that's for sure. So you worked. You and Jack worked a lot in Charlotte. I guess after Jack won the title, right? Y'all work.
Hey, and let me take you to how I ended up in Charlotte, Ron. It's just kind of, you know, Jack and I, when we started, you know, we both, like you, went to school. So we knew there was something better out there than just, you know, hitting those 4 turnbuckles every night. So we kind of had a plan. And so when I started going full time, he said, Gerald, here's going to be our plan. And he said, you're going to go somewhere, and I'm going to go somewhere, and hopefully they'll be close by, and you get over in your territory, and I'll get over my territory. Then we can work tag teams, and we can switch, and I can come up there, and you can come down there, wherever we're at. So we kind of had a game plan. That's kind of how Jack was in Florida, and I ended up, like I said earlier, I was in Australia, Rip Hawk and Sweet Hansen. I got to work with them a lot, and they fell in love with my work, and they were looking for young guys to come into Carolina. As we come in at the right time, Ron, as you look back in your career. And there were a lot of old-timers, you know, just phasing yourself out of the business at that time. And we were coming along at the right time as they were phasing out, and they were looking for young, fresh, new talent. And we fit that bill for them. So Rip Hawk and Sweet Hansen taught me into coming into Carolinas, you know, and I knew that was close to Florida. So Jack and I could do with our plan. So I got over to Carolinas. He got over down here, of course. And the mix of things, when they'd have the big show, the big Greensboro shows and the big Charlotte shows in the Carolinas, Mid-Atlantic area, Jim Crockett Sr. called Eddie, and Jack would come up there and work tag with me and vice versa with my big Miamis and St. Petersburg and Tampa shows. Eddie would call, and Crockett would loan me out, and would come down there. So we actually had the best of 2 territories, you know, going for us at that time.
That's a great plan, you know. And then you got over in one territory, and Jack's really over in Florida, and you were able to swap back and forth. Because I remember you used to come in and work those tag matches. You'd be there just a short period of time, and you'd disappear back to Carolina. And I guess as time went on, he probably started doing the same thing. Up there in Carolina, that was a tremendous territory. I never worked there. I kind of always wanted
to work there. That's unbelievable because it was an awesome territory. And Jim Crockett Sr. was just one of those old school promoters, you know, like we talk about all the time, admire and respect, because he was one of the honest guys and a guy that when he told you what the house was, it wasn't far from being the truth, you know, when he would come in and tell you what the house was to make it pay off. You knew you were getting an honest shot with Jim Crockett Sr.
Yeah, he had a tremendous reputation. You know where he was born?
I think in Tennessee, Dyersburg, Tennessee.
Bristol, Tennessee. Bristol. There, yeah, in the Tri-Cities.
That's where he was buried, final burial place. I was a pallbearer at his funeral.
Oh, is that right, man?
Yeah.
Dog, man. That's quite an honor.
Jeez. It was a huge honor. I still got the announcement at his funeral service that to give out.
That's a tremendous honor. I mean, him and my grandfather were very, very good friends. I mean, obviously, they started about the same time and opened their territories up, and Roy was really close to him. I remember a meeting. I had to tell this one to you real quickly. You'll probably like this. It was a Southern promoter meeting. It was in Charlotte, and I was a young kid. I was probably 17, 18 years old, and somehow I got to go to the deal. And my dad said, sit back over there, the chair against the wall, right? Keep your mouth shut. And basically, it was Nick Gulas and Roy and you know, Eddie. It was the Southern promoters. It was quite a group of them there. And Nick Gulas, and you've probably spent some time around Nick. Nick, in the middle of the meeting, broke out a $1,000 bill. He had a $1,000 bill in his wallet, and he got to showing the $1,000 bill. And, you know, and they, like he was going to impress these guys. I mean, they all could have had $1,000 bills in their pocket. But that was Nick. That was the way he was. And he said, oh, boy, y'all ever seen one of these? It's a $1,000 bill. Hey, let me just pass it around. And he passed it around the table. And everybody took it. And they were trying to be polite, you know, and they would look at it. And, yeah, that's something else, you know. And they passed it to the next guy. And it came all the way around the table. Dad was the last guy. He's sitting next to Nick, but he was the last one to get the $1,000 bill. And they handed it to him, and he just tore it in half.
Oh, I love it.
And Nick went, oh, damn, boy, what did you do? That's a $1,000 bill.
I love it. That's what you get for taking it out in that group of people.
Oh, yeah. And then everybody at the table cracked up, all the other guys. They all laughed. Nick was about to cry, big tears in his eyes. Oh, man. So, did you work Tennessee? You ever work there?
No, I that's one place, you know, I'd always heard the rumors and the horror stories, and I know we're going to talk about Jack, but do you want me to give a quick Jack and Nick Gulas story here?
Yeah, go ahead, man. I love it.
Okay, when Jack first broke into business, of course, it was for Leroy, and we'll get into how he got there and all that stuff a little bit later in our conversation, but As most local guys, you know, you don't stay around your hometown. Back in those days, you didn't stay around your hometown much because, you know, you're getting beat and all that stuff. And promoters, you know, they always say, hey, kid, you know, it's your hometown. We want, but when things get right, when you get the right experience, we want to do some good with it. So you need to leave, in other words. So
right.
He said, Jack, Leroy sent Jack down to Nick Gulas. Well, you know what the payoffs were back then. I mean, we're talking about a college kid that just got out of college, didn't have a dime in his pocket. Of course, my mom was a single mom of six kids. And just finished college, Jack had gotten married and had three kids while he was there. And he had this old beat-up Pontiac. So he drove it down to Tennessee. About his first week in Tennessee, he was making like $10, $15 a night, making those trips, you know, buying gas, buying a six-pack of beer. And that's about all he was existing on. One night, there was a big rainstorm coming back from wherever the hell he was coming back from. I forgot the town. But they had a landslide, and a damn big boulder rolled down the side of the mountain, fell right on the hood of Jack's old Grand Prix, you know, Pontiac, and totaled the damn thing out. Jack told me he had $15 in his pocket. The tow truck driver took Jack to the Greyhound bus station. Jack bought a ticket to Oklahoma. He was going to go back to Oklahoma, quit professional wrestling, and become a coach and teacher. And he got on the damn bus and went back to Oklahoma, came back to Stillwater, and came over the house, told my mom what happened, you know, after he told his wife and everything that he was quitting, he was going to start teaching. Well, Leroy called him right away and said, Jack, well, you ain't quitting. You know, you got too much talent. He said, I've talked to Fritz Von Erich, he's going to take you down in Dallas there and do some good business with you. And so Jack agreed to go down there, and it turned out that was his breaking point, where he met Joe Scarpa, who later became Jay Strongbow. He met Joe Scarpa. Joe really liked Jack's work. Joe was a good friend of Eddie Graham, so Joe knew Eddie was looking for guys like Jack. And so he called Eddie, told Eddie all about Jack, and Eddie made a phone call to Fritz and worked out a swap where Eddie sent somebody out to Texas and Fritz sent Jack to Florida, and then Jack's career took off from there.
Oh, man. Jack told me a story. He changed the make of his car, but early on we talked one night about Tennessee. And he said, yeah, I worked there, you know. And Tennessee was a funny territory. If you ran in Roy's towns, if you got lucky enough to work in Roy's towns, you end up making money. But if you worked in Nick's towns, which was Birmingham at that point, and Chattanooga, and Nashville, you end up starving to death. And I asked Jack, I said, did you ever work in Nashville? And he said, yeah, I did, Ron. And I said, well, how did that go? I mean, you know, how'd you like it? How'd you get treated? And he said, it was a short story. He said, I drove in. He said, I had a nice car. And he said, I rode out on a Greyhound.
That's the story right there. So now you know the rest of the story.
I mean, it was a quick story, and I kind of like shook my head because I'd heard the horror stories before. But that was a darn nasty place to have to work.
Lost Jack Briscoe to the business because of that.
There you go. Nick almost killed one of the best workers of all time. I'm not surprised, you know. And then once he got his boy started, he killed the territory that he had left. It really, really turned bad for him. So bookers, you know, when you go around the country and around the world like you, you deal with a lot of bookers. And who, in your opinion, do you really think was a sharp booker that was one of the better guys at that job? That's such an important job in the business.
I don't know if I'll shock you because you probably knew the guy better than I did, but one of my early favorites, of course, I think the world of Cowboy Bill Watts. I'm probably one of the few that, has total respect for the guy.
I've known
Bill Watts since I was 12 years old, though, we go way, 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 way back. He's Oakie and I, of course, I am too. Bill was one of the first guys that really took the time. Gary Hart, I told you I was in Australia with Gary, and he was there for the length of time I was there. So Gary taught me a lot. But when I went to Carolina, George Booker was booking there, and he was a worker, but he was one of the worst bookers in the entire world that I'd ever been around. I mean, he had no ideas, no clue what to do. So Jim Senior brought in Leroy Garibaldi he was down here in Florida. With Louis Tolette, I believe, and Leo wanted then a main booker out in L.A. So Crockett brought him in there. To me, Leo Garibaldi had, for the 70s, some of the most futuristic thinking and finishes. I really enjoyed working with him. He enjoyed young talent, been around young talent and helping the philosophy, mold the philosophy and your thinking, your career, to modern times. So he was one of my very first favorites. And after that, I'd say George Scott is another guy that was just so bright in this business, a former worker and just had so much in advance, knew what he wanted to do and had shown me. And I learned from him how to book into the future instead of just booking for the next 2 or 3 weeks. George would take the booking and, of course, in Charlotte, your big shows were your Thanksgiving shows. So George had a plan from one Thanksgiving to the next Thanksgiving, which is a year out, And he had a chart that he would write down his programs in, and then had a game plan how to get to the next Thanksgiving. So he showed me a lot. But then I came down here to Florida, and I probably met the master of all bookers, and that being Eddie Graham. And Eddie was off the juice, off the alcohol at the time. So Eddie had a clear mind. When Eddie had a clear mind, there was nobody, and I repeat, nobody in this business that could lay out a finish like Eddie Graham. Eddie's Graham finish would be the entire match. I mean, you'd have to, man, am I going to remember this now? Okay, you go to your opponent. Okay, now help me out there. You know what it was.
Right? He was in.
You didn't mess one spot up, or Eddie knew it, and Eddie would meet you in the locker room door when you got there. Why did you leave that spot out? Why didn't you do this? You can't do that. By all means, the reason I had you doing that was this. it explained to you why it was bad for you leaving something out. But to me, Eddie Graham was a master. And then from Eddie Graham, I go to Pat Patterson, probably been one of the most brilliant men in the racing business and racing finishing business I've ever been around in my entire life.
So you've been around some great ones. Leo, I worked with Leo Garibaldi in 1970 when I went into Florida. He was booking there. And he booked in Atlanta for my dad in the late 60s. He had brought in the Torres brothers, and he just really had it. Leo was really good. And like you say, Eddie, let's talk a little bit about Eddie, man, since you got to Eddie. Probably you felt like I did. Eddie was just a remarkable, remarkable person. You know, not just what he was able to do with booking and how he ran his company, but the type of guy he was as well with the boys' ranches and his he was a very giving guy and had tremendous respect for Eddie. He was just a special person.
Eddie certainly was, and all the ingredients you said there is what really attracted me to Eddie to be a mentor to me. And Eddie was a teacher. Above all, Eddie was a teacher. I mean, you know, anybody can go out there and give you directions and all this stuff, but, you know, Eddie. And then we left one guy out, and it was one of Eddie's guys, at Louis Tillette. Now, Louis Tillette is probably an unknown to a lot of people out there, the name, but he was a very small guy, so he made up for it in his psychology in the ring, and he was able to use that psychology he developed in the ring and to deliver and finishes. And I don't think anybody told you a finish more with the more animation and more facts and the reason why you're doing this than Louis Tillette. I love sitting there watching Louis Tillette go over a finish and give a finish out, but he was a product of Eddie Graham. But back on Eddie. Eddie was a marvelous guy, and you know Eddie had his demons, like we all had our demons. When Eddie was off the bottle, there was nobody brighter and nobody more capable of doing anything in this business than Eddie Graham. He had more influence than Eddie Graham in this business because of the way he broke things down, the way he ran his territory. He ran his territory with class. And that's what he looked for guys that he brought in. He wouldn't bring in the Hellraisers and the guys that would cause a problem and be in the newspaper for the wrong rhyme reasons and stuff like that. He brought in good citizens. He brought in guys that was willing to go out to the schools, willing to go to the business organizations, and that were capable of getting up in front of a crowd and speaking to a crowd of businessmen and speaking to a crowd of school children. That's what he looked for, and he looked for athletes, and we're both blessed to be a part of it. But Eddie Graham was a brilliant man.
Did you ever work with him?
Yes, I did. I worked with him up in North Carolina, and what an experience it was. It was one of those walking tacos because Eddie was well into his prime, past his prime at that time. But it was one of those walk and talk and listen matches. And not comparing myself to you because you've done so much, but you know, the intelligence that Eddie was out there with, and you had to be fairly quick and fairly smart to keep up with Eddie and his deals. But I enjoyed working with him. It was a walk and talk psychology match. And being around all these guys is great. But if you don't learn from them and pick things up from them, like I'm sure you did because of your successful business career, then you're losing out on a great education. And because some of those old timers, they just had a knack about them and had that air about them where they were not only guys that could go out there and show you, but they were guys that could teach you why to do a move, why not to do a move. And that's what I appreciated from the guys. I think that's what in my career I kind of focused more on, you know, the learning aspect because I wanted to advance myself. I didn't want to be in that ring my entire life. I wanted to get out of it. I wanted to be one of them. And so I listened and I learned. And I think that was the most important thing, is being around people that were willing to teach you.
Well, you know, and Eddie, like you said, man, he was a fountain of knowledge, that's for sure. And boy, I remember that every time he talked, it was like the old commercial E.F. Hutton, man. I would just I was tuned in, and you know, I tried to get everything I could from him. I want a real quick story for you. You'll like this, Jerry, knowing Rob, my brother. Rob just were breaking into business, and Dad was in Georgia. Rob was in Georgia, and he'd been working 2 or 3 months, and he was trying to get started. And Dad brought Eddie in for 4 days, 4 matches in a row with Rob. And Eddie wore a mask, right? And Rob tells this story. He said, I thought that Eddie was going to kill me, literally. He was trying to kill me, right? He said he would choke me. He would stick his thumb in my throat. And he said, so he'd dig it in so deep I couldn't breathe at all. And he said he was just doing horrible things to me, you know.
On a headlock, right?
Oh, just everything, you know. And he said,
I had that thumb all from a headlock in my throat.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he would, you know, and he said one time, he said, he got my legs crossed behind me, man. And then he said he was on my back with my legs crossed. And he said he reached down and got my chin. And he stretched me as far back as he could. And he said, then he hit me. He slapped me in the chest. you know, hey, I couldn't imagine, you know, Eddie just having fun. And he said, Dad was back there. He said, I would look back there. And he said, my dad was laughing.
Welcome to the business, son.
Yeah, no rib. And he said, so was Eddie. Eddie was laughing too.
Well, Eddie was a concrete block in that ring, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yes, he was, man. I got a story here. I want to take you to the snake pit. You know, they're in Florida, the old snake
right,
pit.
Right.
There was a writer at one time wrote, and this is an Eddie story, and it's a Jack story, too, at the same time. There was a writer in Tampa that had a little bit of amateur wrestling background, and he wrote this horrible article about wrestling in the paper. And you know how Eddie was. Eddie, like, oh,
He was very protective, yeah.
Oh, my God, he just went nuts. I mean, I got to get this guy in here, you know. I got to get this guy in here. So he sets up a deal, and he invites the guy down, and he invites him to bring cameramen. And he says, Eddie could be very nice and cordial,
right.
You know, but underneath he's seething, man. He's wanting to beat him up personally. Right. And he invites him down. And so the guy shows up, and Eddie gets, Don Curtis out of Jacksonville comes, and Nelson happened to be there, you know, and there's all these shooters and Jack, and he had Jack in there. And I was in there that day, too. I went in to, you know, just do a normal workout, shooting with Roop and Matsuda and whoever might be there on that day. And I didn't know they were having this deal. So I got the pleasure of watching all this whole deal. But so one of the first things he did is he had the guy, since he knew a little bit of wrestling, he said, Jack, come in the ring here, you know, and the guy's got his tights on. The guy comes prepared to wrestle, right? And so he says to the guy, he says, Jack, get on your hands and knees. And he said, well, what would you do if, you know, a guy's in that position? And this reporter, the one that had written the story, he gets down on top of him. And he grapevines him, and he puts an Oklahoma ride on Jack. And I'm watching, big kid, man, real young. You know, this is all interesting to me. So Eddie says to Jack, he goes, well, Jack, what would you do to get him off your back here? So Jack just pushes up on his feet and on his hands so that the guy's all stretched out. He got nothing much to hold on to anymore. And he says to the guy's on his back, and the guy's straining now like crazy, you know, to have to turn loose of his Oklahoma ride. And Jack takes his left hand, and he puts a little X on the mat. He draws a little X with his finger. He says, see that right there? To the guy. He says, see that right there? And the guy says, yeah, I see it. And he says, that's where your head's going. And he ducked that shoulder under and buried that guy face first. Oh, my gosh. it was me. I don't know, me and Roop and 2 or 3 other guys. And we all just broke up, kind of trying to hide it. You know, maybe we had anybody getting mad, man. We're laughing. You know, it's like. We kind of backed off, you know, and then later on, so he has the guy, Art Nelson puts the sugar on him.
Right.
It shows him the sugar. And then the guy finally, he's pretty well been roughed up pretty good right now. He's thinking, well, this is a lot different than I thought it was. So he says, Eddie asks him, he says, now, is there any other thing that you've seen that you think is fake? So he says, well, he says the sleeper hole. So and now Don Curtis. There's Don Curtis, right? So now they got two photographers, not one, but two photographers. And they've been taking all these shots. They've shown that face first drive into the mat. They've shown the sugar hole. They've shot all this stuff. And so then Don gets into the ring and he goes and he's talking to the guy. And the guy's talking to him. He gets behind him and he don't lock down on it, but he puts his arms around his. He gets ready to put him to sleep. And he's talking to basically the photographers that are taking the picture. And he goes, well, you know, you can do this in a real easy way. And it can do it in such and such. And the guy's asleep. The guy's already gone. Boom. He's out. Right. And he's just holding him there. Right? So he lets him go. And the guy, he falls on his face. He's out. He ain't moving nowhere, right? So then Curtis leaves him laying there for probably 20 seconds. He don't touch him or anything. He lets the photographers take all the shots, man. There he is. He's out, you know. And then he reaches down and he pats him on the back of that neck. And the guy jumps almost up on his feet. It's like, and he goes, see, I told you he couldn't put me out. and he'd been laying there for 30 seconds. It's like, oh. So they went back. This guy went back, and he wrote the next day. He changed everything that he had written.
Changed his tune, huh?
Oh, his whole tune, man. What a great write-up it was then, man. If you don't think that it's real, go down there to 106 North Albany, man.
Yeah.
And they'll you give you a lesson.
That was Jack's last time he ever did that. He told Eddie he wasn't going to do that anymore. He said, I'm not going to hurt any guys anymore. He said, that's not my job. That's not what I'm here for.
Yeah.
He said, and Eddie got mad. I got upset, of course. He said, Jack, you got to protect the business. Jack said, I will if they get in the ring with me. He said, but I'm not going to do somebody writing stuff. I'm just not that way. And Jack wouldn't have. Jack always refused to do that. He, that Mad Suter, that Bob Roop. Roop would go in and hurt you, you know, and Matt Suter just wear your ass out where you wish you were hurt.
Oh, yeah, he wished you'd hurt you. He hurt you in his own way. I spent a lot of time in there, man. And Jack, I used to shoot some with Jack. And, God, that was ridiculous. I mean, Jack was so damn good. He would tell me, he'd say, I'm going to fireman carry you, Ron. You know, you're getting ready to take me down. He'd say, I'm going to fireman's carry you. And he says, I'm going to do it left-handed. then I'm going to do it right-handed, you know. And he'd tell me what he was going to do. And I'm just doing my best to block it. I mean, it ain't going to happen. You ain't going to get it, you know. And boom, boom, boom. It was like, gosh, almighty, was unreal. And I remember
blocking Jack.
No blocking him. I mean, he was just he was unbeatable at that particular move. I see why he never got taken down his senior season, his last season.
No, he did. He did not. Not a senior season or in the last 2 years of high school, he never got taken down. That first year of college wrestling, of course, those guys, you know, when Jack come in, he was still a teenager and he was wrestling 22-year-old men, you know. They took him down one time. I think he got taken down one time in his college career.
That's just unreal, man. I mean, you know, and you don't lose matches when you don't get taken down in the amateur. You're not going to lose many matches, that's for darn sure. When I got him in there, you know, I love Jack. He taught me so much. And he was such a great guy to be around. And he would blow me up. He would blow me up really bad. And I would be fighting like crazy just to get to the ropes and get a little breath. And one time I got so blown up that I fought to the edge of the ring because I was going to puke. I mean, I didn't want to puke in the ring. I got to the
funny
edge
story
of the ring.
About old Ole Anderson. He thought he could hang with Jack. You know, Ole was a big guy, 285, 295. Jack was what, 2 1/4 maybe.
Right.
You know, when he was heavy. And so Ole went out there with him one night in Greenville, South Carolina. And he said, you know, we made the match was like 20 minutes. Back in those days, you know, we went some time. So Ole had been working out. I'm gonna get this guy. Jack started being stiff with Jack. And Jack was, you know, even though Jack was so good like that, Jack never had to show that he was good like that because he just had that air about him that he was good. You didn't mess with him, you know. But Ole being Ole, you know, I'm going to show this to this rookie, you know, what this business is. And Ole came out of that ring, his tongue was hanging down to his knees. And he said, man, I never knew a guy with such skinny arms who could possess such powerful Superman strength. He said, I've never wrestled anybody like that in my life. And Jack just looked at him, Ole, you shouldn't have tried, you know. And well, without him taking a deep breath, then lit up a Marlboro and smoked a Marlboro.
I tell you,
Jack Briscoe warm up, smoked a pack of Marlboros, three jumping jacks, and go out and do an hour. You know?
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, I got to the edge of the ring that day, man, and I vomited off into the floor. And he grabbed me by the feet and drug me back in and started again. So then I crawled the other side of the ring and buked again. Oh boy, he was just something else. And you're right. I mean, what idiot would be, you know, having realized or even known that he was that damn good would want to try him? Anybody ever try you, man?
Oh yeah, you know, I was a little brother, so I always had guys. I'm coming up as Jack Briscoe's little brother was quite an experience in college and high school, you know, because Jack was one of the guys you didn't want to mess with, you know, and I didn't have the size that Jack had. And I did pretty fair as an athlete myself, but I didn't have the records and accolades that Jack had, of course. So I'd go somewhere and it was either somebody's going to buy me a beer or somebody wanted to fight me, you know, one of the two.
Yeah.
I prefer the guys to buy me beers, you know, but you know, every once in a while, I'd hook them up with some guys, just depending on the family name, you know. And but in the business, I got a tap on Danny Hodge on the back where he saved me a couple of times. You probably remember the guy, Jerry the Barber Miller, old Jerry Miller.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you remember that name. He was a journeyman back in our early days. And there was a Russian Khrushchev or something like that. I can't remember the guy for a Russian first name. He was a legit Russian. One of those little typical Russians, barrel chest, about 5'8", 5'9", 280 pounds, you know, just barrel chested as hell and strong as hell. Yeah, you know, you're letting guys, because it's a work, and I'm a rookie, so I'm not going to be fighting back very hard. You know, and this guy, you know, he wants to wrestle a bit. And I thought it was kind of cool. Then all of a sudden, I started feeling this pressure coming on me, and it getting tighter and tighter. Damn Russian trying to work into that damn sure hold on me. Well, I'm smart enough to know what that is. That's not a working hold. And the referee, Angelo Martinelli, told me, kid, you better start fighting out of that. So I was about to pass out before I got smart enough, hey, this guy's not working anymore. So I shot out of there. The first thing I did, I got to my base, and then I shot an elbow back. He was dumb enough to hang that head of his head down to my side there. So I brought that elbow back as far as I could to create some distance. I shot out of him. I shot out from underneath him. Turned around and wizard his ass over and put my own damn sleeper sugar hold on him. I never had any trouble from him there on out. But Hodge told me it was going to happen, and I still wasn't smart enough to know when it was happening. You know, I just, because Hodge had heard the locker room talk, oh, I'm going to show this college kid, you know, what this business is all about. And the table got turned on him. Then, oh, Leroy, you know, he used to run all those little towns. And, you know, a lot of the little towns, they'd have like a Texarkana championship, Longview championship. So I'd worked up and gotten over. And so they were going to put one of those little local city champion. The first title I ever had was the Longview, Texas champion. And Jerry Miller had the title. So that night, Miller was leaving. So, the thing to do back in our days was you're leaving the territory, you put the next guy over, and you put him over right in the middle of the ring gladly, you know. But like I said, I wasn't the biggest guy in the world or or anything like that. And Miller kind of looked at me and said, Miller was pretty good side, dude. You know, I should have to put him over. And of course, the referee, they, you know, they really wants it. You know, he's an upcoming guy and all that stuff. And so Hodge came to me, kid, and he said, during tonight's match, really watch yourself because Miller's going to try you. And he's not too happy about putting you over. I said, what I do, Danny? He said, just take care of yourself. That's all I need to tell you. So I went out in the match, you know, first 5-10 minutes, match was going okay. Then all of a sudden you feel that, you know, you can feel it. You know, I've been around wrestling since I was 6 years old. So I kind of had that feel when guys were getting ready to start clamping down on you. So I felt that grip getting a little tighter, that body weight getting a little heavier. All of a sudden, you know, he got me in a position where pretty compromised where he could pass me out if he wanted to. And so I looked out in the back and I actually get Hodge kind of looking out of the back of the curtain there. So same thing, man. I explode out of there and I do a couple of moves to Miller, and pretty soon he's screaming and hollering and let me go. And I'm, you know what? I'm having fun now and I'm not letting him go.
Yeah.
For
your turn.
10 minutes, he's trying to run out of the ring, trying to do everything he can, and he cannot escape from me. And finally, the referee said, Briscoe, you done beat him to death. Now pin him. So there's old Jack Boss. Jack got there in Oklahoma. So I turned the guy over, half Nelson, turned him over, and I just pinned him without a finish, basically just a old half Nelson body press, finish 1, 2, 3, and got my first title, a little trophy, or a Texarkana championship. You know, coming to the back, Hodge said, I told you, but you did all right, kid. And that was all I needed right here to hear that. But you did all right, kid.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a good one.
So other than that, I really didn't have a lot of guys. You know, they knew Ron. I mean, they knew I was a wrestler. You know, they knew who I was. And, you know, some guys would get a little stiff, but it was kind of in a joking kind of way. And I didn't mind that because I enjoyed, you know, I enjoyed guys being snug. Like Ole Anderson, I brought his name up. I really didn't care for Ole Anderson's business practices or the way he did business or the way he treated talent. But I loved being in a ring with him because he was on you. He was smothering you all the time. If you didn't fight back, hey, it was your fault. And so, you know, it makes you a better worker. It makes you a better talent. If you get somebody like that every once in a while, that will push you and teach you, you know, you got a different level.
Yeah.
And Ole and Bill Watts were two guys that were very good at bringing that other level out of me. And I appreciated that. And like I said, I didn't like the business practices of Ole or the way he treated people, but I enjoyed being in a ring with him. And I enjoyed him being snug with me because I always knew I could beat him. You know? So I had no problem with that.
Yeah, I got it. You brought up two guys here just in the last few minutes, Danny Hodge and both Dale Lewis. And you probably don't know this. When I first started Southeastern, I was a big kid, 26 years old, and I went to Knoxville. And I brought Dale Lewis. Dale came and worked for me. And I got him to wrestle the mark. I pinned $1,000 bill on the lapel of his suit every TV show. And then he would wrestle the marks because, you know, that was old Ron Wright and Don Wright country. And they'd never seen
torn up a $1,000 bill.
Yeah.
That torn up $1,000.
No, this one was a whole one. I had him going out and wrestling the marks. And it was that part of the country was used to Ron Wright and Don Wright and the chisel and the blood and all that stuff. And I wanted to try to get fans to appreciate wrestling. So Dale was really, you know how Dale worked with people. He was really sweet to him. I wouldn't have done it with anybody but Dale, you know, because he had that laid back attitude. He wasn't going to hurt guys, and he just rolled them around there.
Attitude,
There you go. But Danny was working for me some too. Danny Hodge, right? So Danny, one night we're standing up on the balcony, and Dale's wrestling a mark down there, The mark early in the match, Dale pushes him back into the ropes, and then he's going to let him go like Dale is and turn around and back to. Yeah. And the guy tried to stick his fingers in his eyes, reached for his eyes, right? And Hodge went, hey, he screamed out.
You see there, Hodge like, getting goosebumps now.
Yeah. Oh, yes. So Danny screams at him, right? You know, and then so Dale don't do anything. He's just calm and everything. and he backs him into the turnbuckle. And this time the referee breaks and the guy takes an actual swing at him.
Right.
Oh, and that's it. And Hodge is standing next to me and I'm going, Danny, no, Danny, don't go down there. Don't go down there. And boy, when the guy takes the swing, Danny, here he goes, man. And he's got to go downstairs to the where the ring is. And he goes down there and he's screaming so loud. The crowd's kind of quiet because they don't know really what's going on. And Danny's screaming at Dale. And he says, stop that son of a bitch. Stop that son of a bitch's head. And I'm up there going, oh, no, please, Dale, don't. You know, I'm going to get sued, you know, if you do. And so Dale was standing there, and the guy's kind of standing there, too. And Danny just won't stop. Stop his head. So Dale takes him down, and I'm up there screaming, no, no. Oh, good, right? And so Dale's on top of him, and he's pretty about 3 feet away from Danny in there. And Danny's still screaming at him, and he says, stomp his head! And then he goes to Dale, he goes, if you don't stomp his head, I'm going to come in there and stomp yours.
Yeah, and Lois probably started stomping.
Oh, boy. And he gets up off this guy, and the guy's laying there. He's half blown up anyway. And I'm screaming top of my lungs, no, no. And Dale stomps him right in the face. Blood squirts across the ring. I'm like, oh, wow. My goodness gracious. That was Dale's last shoot.
That was his last shoot. I don't blame him, man. You never know what he got. I mean, Lewis was brutal. I mean, he was so damn big and powerful that he really didn't know his own strength and size. And that big, massive body gets on you. And You had to fight to get out from underneath him, even at a work. And I always said, Dale Lewis was two-time NCAA champion on a Division I at the University of Oklahoma. But he was the most boring wrestler in amateur wrestling I'd ever seen in my life. He won two national championships. I don't think a guy got over two takedowns in his entire career. And he just happened to come in the NCAA championships. His matches would either end 2-1 or 1-1 or a draw. I mean, the guy just, he was non-action the entire time. When he got into pro business, that kind of, it really kind of shocked me because Dale, as you know, he didn't have that really outgoing personality. He was a sweetheart of a guy. I mean, a wonderful person, wonderful man, and just an outstanding all-around dude. But as far as action, he had a lack of action like nobody I'd ever seen. But he was so convincing because of his size and his power. People believed in him, you know. They got over.
He was slow. His movements were always slow. And, you know, even when he was working, you know, after he started working, he didn't have a whole lot of excitement. You're right. And, you know, you couldn't have a real good match with him because he wasn't going to move. He wasn't going to get around and do too much during the course of a match, but, you know, that was
an advantage. It was going to be solid and believable.
Oh, damn right. For darn sure. And, you know, and he did a lot for me. We did that deal. He shot sometimes with five guys a night. He would do his match, and then he would go out there, and they would line up in the corner, and he'd take them one at a time, and he'd just slowly.
Crazy people, five of them. After about two of them, I think if I was that third or fourth guy, I think I would have got smart by then.
I don't want none of that, you know. But, no, these were old redneck hillbilly guys, you know. They just believed that, hell, you know, I can beat him for $1,000. I'm going to get that $1,000.
Yeah, damn right. That was a year's paycheck.
Yeah, it turned out costing me money, man, that whole gimmick. That whole deal, once the stomp went down, then the lawsuit started. But that was a strange day and time back in those days. Brian?
It was what used to frustrate me about those guys. I'm going to go beat on Oldie a little bit more, but, you know, guys like that, and there's a lot of other guys around, but he just happens to come to mind. He would put guys in smaller guys to go in against these guys and blow them up first where the guy didn't have an ounce of energy left. Then Oldie would roll in the ring and start roughhousing with them, you know, beating them up, and because the guys had no energy left. And I just never had respect for that type of of gamemanship. You know, I mean, I didn't mind the guys going in. I mean, guy wants to learn how to wrestle. You know, he maybe might be a smart ass. We'll go in and blow his ass up and put a few stretching moves on him, but don't go in and break his nose and break his arms and stuff like that. There's no call for that. I mean, there's other ways of showing your point, but tough guy wants to be a tough guy, you know?
Yep. Oh, Brian, you got some questions, I'm sure, my man.
Yeah, you know? I got a few. You know, one, I'm really curious what you think, Jerry. Talked about Eddie Graham earlier. Obviously, Eddie would pass in early 1985. If Eddie had lived, what do you think he would have done in wrestling? Because obviously the Florida office would only last a little while longer, and it ends up just being a two-man race. Jim Crockett Promotions with Dusty Rhodes as the booker versus Vince McMahon. Do you see Eddie as a guy who would eventually work for Vince and help with the creative end of it? Do you see him as a guy who would work against Vince? If Eddie had lived, what do you think Eddie would have done?
You know, that's an excellent question. And, you know, I can take you back. Eddie and Vince Sr. were extremely tight. And Ron knows this. I mean, we used to bring Vince Sr. down to Miami when he was down vacationing. We'd bring him to the convention center. Then we started running Hollywood, Florida. And we would bring him in there. And we'd even sanction matches with his champion, you know, with Vince Sr.'s champion, with the Backlund or Bruno or whoever the champion was, Billy Superstar Graham and those guys. We'd bring those guys in. Eddie had such a dynamic relationship with Vince Sr. that, he really didn't have the relationship with Vince Jr. That he had with the old man. But, you know, unfortunately at that time, and my brother and I saw it coming, that's the reason we made our move. We saw what was coming down the pike everything evolves, and it was like, even when we came into the business, Ron, I think we're part of an evolution process from the decades before that, because we're the young studs coming out, the guys that we were competing against really weren't our age. You know, they were past their prime, so we come along at a pretty damn good time in the business where a lot of guys were being phased out, and a lot of us young guys were getting all openings and opportunities. And but I think Eddie would have stayed true as long as he could with the NWA, because Eddie was the NWA guy. But I think eventually he would have saw the writing on the wall and piled up with Vinnie Mac. And I think Vinnie Mac's ascension would have been a little quicker than, even though it was like a freight train, it probably would have been a bullet train coming through with Eddie's backing. But that didn't happen. And, you know, and then unfortunately Eddie had his demons. And so, we'll never know.
We talked a little bit last time about how Jack first won the NWA title. What was that schedule like for him? You know, he had about a year and a half as the champion, dropped the belt to Giant Baba in the middle of it. What was that schedule, the NWA champions touring schedule, like for him?
Wow. He showed me one time. We're both in Atlanta TV. I came down from the Carolinas. He was doing a shot, just passing through, getting ready to build up somebody for the Omni. And he just got Barnett was a NWA president. Jim came and gave him an envelope. He handed the envelope to me. I looked at that 22nd, 23rd, 24th, 25th, 26th, 27th, 28th, 29th, 30th, 1, 2, 3, 3rd down to 30. About 8 weeks in a row with 2 days off. And I looked at that schedule. And, then, you know, I mean, the NWA, we were like in Atlanta one night, Portland, Oregon the next night, and Dallas, Texas. There was no rhyme or reason for the bookings. Whenever the promoter had a big show, whether you were in Portland and they were having a big show in Atlanta, Georgia, or in Richmond, Virginia, you had to be out there, and then you had to go continue your tour out in Salem, Oregon, or somewhere like that. It was brutal. I remember one night we're in Richmond, Virginia. And I drove Jack to D.C. because they had a direct flight from D.C. like at midnight. Crockett put me on early so I could drive Jack up there, to put Jack on earlier, I should say, and me on earlier so I could drive Jack to D.C. to the airport there. He caught a plane to Tokyo, Japan, went over and worked a match with Baba to set up the title drop. And then that was on Friday night, I believe. Then Saturday, or Saturday, whatever night, St. Louis is on Friday night, whatever the dates were, not important, but the story is. So whatever the date was. So I took him from Richmond to the airport after he worked an hour Broadway with Ole or one of the guys, Eric Sarda. Took him to D.C., got on plane, flew direct to Tokyo, Japan, got off the plane in Tokyo and went and worked an hour Broadway with Jumbo Truda that night in Tokyo. They took him straight to the airport. I picked Jack up whatever night St. Louis was, two nights later in St. Louis Airport, took him to the arena, watched him do an hour draw with Harley Race. I mean, three nights in a row from Richmond, Virginia, Tokyo, Japan, St. Louis, Missouri, 3 1-hour draws in between.
You do that run to Tokyo, man. I mean, people don't really realize, you know, what that does to you and the time changes and all that stuff. And
they change.
You know, yeah, I mean, and you get off the plane and then you go right in and work an hour. You don't sleep much on those damn planes. And and that flight was probably straight through from D.C. to Tokyo was probably, 14, maybe 18, 16, 18 hours. You know, I mean, you know, you're almost a, people just don't, you know, and then, like you said, get right back on that plane and go back to America. Guy's got to be a superhuman, you know, you got to be
a superhuman, go back to America and then in a premier city at NWA. And then with one of the business all time tough guys, Harley Race, to do another hour of Broadway. Conditioning and the sacrifices that my brother and all those champions, you know, went through, I mean, at that time was just horrific. But you know what? They chose that. They were the chosen ones, and they cherished that role. And I can't think of too many that didn't really pick up the tempo and enhance that position while they were in it. You know, I a ton of respect for the NWA champion, you know, up to Fonz and Briscoe, you know, and, after it became a rent a champ, you know, you could be a champion for $20,000 for a night, you know, promoter put it up for you. And they started switching that title, and that to me really diminished the value of it. And really, I think, hurt the NWA WCW, you know, all along with that by having so many. And I understand what they were trying to do. They were trying to make different champions to draw, you know, for survival, but you're diminishing the golden trellis that got you there, that which is that NWA title. They're diminishing that by putting it on so many different people and so quickly. And I always was against that. I mean, you know, Ric Flair 15 time, and I love Ric Flair to death. I think he's a great champion, a 15 time world champion. Well, hell, that means you got beat 14 times too, you know. I just think once it became a rent a champ belt, I think it lost its luster at that time. And I think that really what gave Vince, because he was pretty consistent with his champion. Hogan was champion, and Hogan was champion forever, you know. And then he got some other guys hot, you know, with Rock, Stone Cold, and Triple H and all those guys, and they went on to become great champions. But I think that's what hurt the NWA is when they started switching the title around so much. And that's just me, you know.
Let me ask you about someone who I believe is a mutual friend of all of ours. And that's Les Thatcher. Jerry, tell me about Les Thatcher. And also, I believe you and Jack and Les, you know, one of the early examples of wrestling merchandise, you guys were selling T-shirts in the 70s in the magazines.
Isn't that something? I mean, you know, I tell people that, and I still don't think people get the gist of it and get the reality of it. I mean, you know, we were, you know, Les and I were friends in Charlotte. Well, I come into Charlotte, Les took a liking to me, and Les is a great teacher. Les has turned out to be one of the greatest trainers, coaches in America and the entire world now. He's trained some tremendous talent and got a tremendous amount of love and respect for Les and after all these years. But he and I became road partners, and, you know, we're both young, and I like to go to those old rock and roll concerts. And one night we went to a concert, I think a Rod Stewart concert. And I saw all these good-looking, beautiful young ladies and guys walking around with Rod Stewart T-shirts on. You know, and I was hotter than a firecracker in the Carolinas at that time. I said, man, I'd like a T-shirt. And he said, why don't we talk about that? So the next night, we were going somewhere on a road trip. And after the road trip, we popped a cold one, was headed down the road. And we were passing by by Winston-Salem as a home of Hanes t-shirt. And Les said, you know what? I bet you we could go there and then buy a lot of their seconds. You know, the t-shirts that didn't make the Hanes label, they were selling at seconds. And I got this buddy that's an artist, and we have Jerry Lawler who draw up the sketchings, and we'll make it some t-shirts, and we'll talk to Crockett and see if we can sell them. And it's getting summertime there and in Carolina. Great, let's do it. So the next day, Les comes over to my apartment. We call up the Hanes, and we get us an order of like 500 t-shirts. Les calls Jerry Lawler and asks Jerry if he'd do an etching of me, Thunderbolt Patterson, Les, and believe it or not, Tim Woods. And believe it or not, we even had Andre the Giant sign a contract with us for merchandising. And so we had him do all the sketching. We sent the artwork up to Burlington, the way he had a friend that was a printer up there. And he put our images on t-shirts. And now, okay, we got all these damn t-shirts. What are we going to do with them? So Bill Apter, as everybody know, Bill Apter was a friend of the Raster. So he had these magazines. So we called Bill, and we sent him a couple of shirts first. He's great. Now, Bill, would you run an ad for us and, you know, Wrestling Review and stuff like that? And he said, sure. And I'll talk to Stanley and see what he'll do. And he said, you guys give me stories. He said, I bet you'll accomplish the damn thing to you. So we got a little business card type ad in all those Stanley Wesson magazines. And in the meantime, it was summertime, and Jim Crockett loved to run the ballparks in the summertime, baseball park, because his family owned a minor league baseball team. So he had connections with all the minor league parks around North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. So I'd go and I'd find them. Les and I would scout the audience. We'd find the two best-looking ladies in the audience and give them T-shirts, tight T-shirts, and have them walk around the audience with a T-shirt. And during intermission and during breaks, we'd set them out there and let them sell a T-shirt for us. And we were selling T-shirts like crazy. I mean, it's unbelievable. And I had a two-bedroom apartment, and we come over with the post office. We got a post office box, and we'd go to the post office box, get all the orders, and come back to my apartment, and we'd hand address every damn t-shirt we sent out, put a little thank you note in there. We were selling hundreds and hundreds of t-shirts, and all of a sudden, it started getting wintertime while the ballparks were drying up. So go to the building. Well, the buildings, of course, okay, we'll supply you sellers and everything, but you got to pay us a percentage. So then they want a percentage, or big profit. We were paying the buildings, whatever percentage it was. And then Crockett said, hey, guys, I want in on the action, too, because we were selling so bad. I was making more money off my T-shirt sales than I was off my wrestling payoff. So Crockett wanted his deal. So, Les had got another booking, and he had left the Carolinas, and I was getting ready to go down to Florida. So I told Crockett, no, we're just not going to do it anymore. So then I brought it down. Of course, Jerry Prater, we all know Jerry Prater. He used to write the Grapevine magazine for Eddie and Championship Wrestling in Florida. So I talked to him. He put a little ad in it, and we kind of based it out of the body shop at the time there. So we did it, and then things started going and moving along different directions and everything. And we just kind of slowly phased out of that business. But, yeah, we were the first ones ever. And I say ever. There's probably somebody somewhere down the line that can make a statement they were first, and they were great, but we're one of the first ever to mainstream pro wrestling t-shirts.
You know, one of the eras that I'm a real big fan of is you and Jack in 83 and 84. You guys as heels in Mid-Atlantic, and it just seems like you guys are both having a ball. Every time I see a local promo, it just seems like you guys are having the greatest time. But I also love 84. You guys come up as baby faces to work for Vince after you make the deal to sell the Georgia stock. And I want to ask you about Mid-Atlantic, but starting with the WWF in 84, I'm a big fan of those matches you guys had against Dick Murdoch and Adrian Adonis. What do you remember about working with them? And were you guys going to go over and get the tag team titles before Jack decided to retire?
I'll start first with Adrian and Dickie. We'd known Dickie forever. Dickie was probably one of the first guys I met when I very first started wrestling in the business. As Ron knows, the old promoters used to send the rookies to the other territories, the other territories would send young guys back for TV, and you'd go down and do favors for the guys, the rising guys in the other territory. With me, it was funny. I went to two places, and I never got asked back. And the reason I never got asked back, both places I went to, the first match I did, I would do a job. And the promoters seemed to like me so well. And Amarillo, of course, Fonsignor, and up in Kansas City, it was Geigel and O'Connor. They liked me. I'd probably do a job the first time I went in. And then my second match of the day, I'd either go to Broadway or get a disqualification. They wouldn't beat me. And then they'd take me into the office, sit down, and try to recruit me. And as soon as I get back to Oklahoma, Mo Gurk would call me and ask me, which one tried to recruit you this time? Because he knew what was going on, because he was doing the same thing with their talent. So I was only sent to those places a couple times before McGurk realized, you know, what the sales pitch I was getting when I go there. But what was your question? I'm sorry.
Working with Adonis and Murdoch, and were you guys going to get the tag team titles?
Anyway, we'd known Dickie forever, you know, through Amarillo. I'd known Dickie forever through Amarillo. And Adrian actually, my brother and I had some rental houses here in Tampa. And so when Adrian came to Florida, him and Don Morocco rented a duplex that we had over by the body shop from us. And so I got to be good friends with him. So we were friends going into this thing. So when they told us, you know, we were going to work for these guys and they were tag team champs, we said, great, because we'd both come in. It was kind of one of those things where Vince calls just out of the blue. He had to let, matter of fact, the Fabulous Freebirds go, and then he had some issues with the Samoans. And so he called us to ask if we'd fill in for those guys because they lost two tag teams through disciplinary actions there. So we agreed to come up for 6 to 8 months. That's all Jack wanted to do. And like we'd made that sell. So financially, we were pretty stable. So plus we had our body shop business and a couple other businesses going here. And so we went up, and the match just seemed to click and seemed to get over. And we ended up going nationwide. And George Scott was the booker at the time. And George really liked Jack and I from a long ways back. So he was talking to us. WrestleMania 1 was coming up. He was kind of telling us, briefing us what was going on, and kind of hinting towards that heel turn. You know, we'd come up, okay, you take the belt from Murdoch and Adonis, then we'll put you with Mike Rotundo and Barry Windham. And that scared the hell out of Jack, you know, having these belts up here, because we were already going. Vince, I mean, it was brutal back in the early WWF days. We would go 70, 80, 90 days in a row. I think Sheik and Volkoff holding the record for 135 days in a row without a day off. And you talk about crisscross the country. We were crisscrossing the country. So that match got over. And when George told us that, you know, that he was looking to put the titles on us and wanted to know if we'd turn heel on Windham, Jack took me aside. He said, Gerald, he said, now it kind of sounds silly. So I'm 40 years old. I can't do this stuff. You know, 40 years old now, these guys, you're just getting started, you know. So,
yeah.
But Jack had knew he had lost that step, and he knew he could not give the, because they'd seen what we'd done with Steamboat and Youngblood. And Jack said, I can't keep up with these two young guys anymore. He said, lost the step. He said, I don't really want to do it. And that's what led to the famous blizzard there in New Jersey when Morocco picked something. We're headed down to Philly, and there was a blizzard. We couldn't tell which way to go. And Jack heard an airplane, and it looked like it was headed south. He said, see that plane, Gerald? I said, yep. He said, it's headed south. He said, I'm going to be on the next one. He said, you go on to Philly if you want to with Don, but I'm leaving, you know, because that scared the death out of him when he said we were going to go with Rotunda and Windham, because they were two young studs just getting ready to go, and both of them were phenomenal athletes and two studs that you couldn't hold back very long. And Jack knew that he couldn't have the same quality of matches that we'd had with Youngboat and Steamblood. And he didn't want to give the fans any less than his best. And he said, it's time for me to quit. He quit. He went home and he took off his watch, and he never put on another watch the rest of his life.
Those matches would have been great. As a fan, I would have loved to have seen you guys against Windham and Rotunda in 1985. But to take a step back, 83, Steamboat and Youngblood have a record-setting program with Slaughter and Carnotal. That big final match was, a lot of people say, the precursor to Starrcade and the closed circuit events that Jim Crockett would have. You guys then come in And I'm a big fan of you guys feuding with Steamboat and Youngblood. I said it before, it appeared that you guys were having a lot of fun. How much fun were you guys having at Mid-Atlantic in 83? Did you enjoy, and did Jack enjoy being a heel?
It was the most fun I ever had consistently in the business in my life, and the easiest job I've ever had working with two guys I ever had in my life. Those guys were like working with, I don't even know how to say it, working with the invisible man. I mean, you knew they were there because you could feel them, but they were so good and so smooth and so precise and just made the match so easy. You had four guys out there that, number one, none of us had any egos, you know, none of us, all four of us was out there. Basically, Jack and I wanted to beat every record that Canoodle and Slaughter ever set, which they set a record in every building they worked in. And we ended up breaking every record that they set, too, with those two guys. Hurricane Helms, he's a funny, funny guy. He's, you know, he's real popular on Twitter and on social media. He was just a teenager at the time. He said, "You guys were the first two wrestlers that I honestly hated." He said, "I loved you guys so much. And then when you did what you did," he said, I've never hated two guys so bad because you broke my heart. And I've never had so many people, and wrestlers tell me the same thing, you know, that was probably the peak. And, you know, I got to be what I always wanted to be, a smart-ass, wise-ass little brother, you know. I'd stand behind Jack. Okay, you might be able to beat my ass. You might be able to go me. But right after you do that, and you're worn out, and I tag this guy in, what you going to do then, you know?
Yeah.
And Jack would just sit there and smile. We didn't have to do a whole lot except smile and talk a little arrogant, talk a little bold, and be a little brash, which was easy for us to do. And if you remember back, we really didn't change our style. We weren't all out heels, but also, you know, everybody says that was your first heel turn. But if you think back, you know, back in the 70s, Jack and I worked with the Funk Brothers. We worked with them everywhere. We worked with them here in Florida. They were the bad guys. But we also went out to Amarillo in that Texas territory and worked with those guys out there. We worked with Funk Brothers in Texas, two Oklahoma Indian boys against two Texas Cowboys. We worked heel out there and worked the same way. And so it wasn't our first run as a tag team heel, because we'd done it part-time out in Texas and everything, and then drew record houses out there also. So we'd had a little bit of knowledge on how to do it, and we kind of even teased a turn down here in Florida, and Eddie wouldn't let us go through with it against Mike Graham and Steve Kern. And we had some barn burner matches with those two guys, and business was picking up like crazy. And Eddie got a little worried because this was a babyface territory. And he said, I need you guys as babyfaces. So he wouldn't let us do that thing full scale. And I always wondered what it would have been like if Eddie would have green-lighted that turn with Mike and Steve. It'd probably been just like the one in Carolina with Ricky and Jay. But I put saying that Jay Youngblood, you know, as Ron knows, he's a Romero. And we'd have had, you know, I'd known the Romero family. They're a lot like the Fuller family and Wolf family. They go back generations in Southwest Texas and Mexico. And the family was a first-class family, a wonderful family to work for. And the Romeros, every one of them were so talented. It's just unbelievable, the talent that came out of that family also. So we had two guys that was willing to do anything we wanted to do, and we were willing to try anything they wanted to try. So we just had that, you know, sometimes you get in a ring and you just got that mysterious thing called magic, and it just works. And it just happened to ignite a fire, and we got on fire. And it was a great run and a great memory.
One last question for you, and then I'll turn things back over to Ron. A very popular subject here on the Studcast and Super Studcast has been various wrestling wars. We've talked about the Atlanta Wrestling War, and we spent a lot of time talking about the Knoxville War, 1979, which, of course, was something Ron was in the middle of. It happened to him. It happened to Southeastern Wrestling. Have you seen the Plan B video of Bob Roop and Ron Garvin and Malenko and Orton exposing the business? And if so, what do you think of the fact that they took it to that extent when they decided to go to war with Ron in Knoxville?
You know, I never saw that, and I've heard of it. Is it on the internet where I can watch it sometime?
Yeah, it's on YouTube. Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called, I think it would, you look up Plan B wrestling video or Bob Root Plan B, because okay. That's what they refer to it as in the video. They said this is Plan B, and it's the four of them exposing the business as they were on the losing end of the war.
I'd heard about it, and I know what it's about and everything, but like I said, I've never physically seen it. So, but I tell you, when I heard about it, especially those four guys that you mentioned, Group, I had so much respect for Group and have so much respect for Bob Group. He was an Olympian and great amateur wrestler, great professional wrestler, great entertainer, and a great man all the way around. One of the kindest, brightest men I've been around. And Ronald attests to that. Bob Group is a brilliant young man. But Malenko, you know, second generation, it was hard at the time. And then did it get heat with me? Sure did. I couldn't believe what those guys had done, but, you know, also, bright enough to know it's a business and, you know, all rules and regulations are pulled sometimes when you're fighting a battle like they were fighting. But would I have done something like that? I don't believe so. I mean, I didn't have anything at stake, but I can honestly sit here and say it would take an awful lot for me to kind of turn on, people that were taking care of me like they did and blatantly go out and tell the public. It was like that one that I do that remember seeing was the mask guy. I believe Harley was involved in it, and I couldn't believe he was too. When the mask guys came out and the secrets of professional wrestling, you know, back a few years ago when they were doing all the exposés, you know, Magic Man wrestlers and all that stuff. I mean, I did see that one, and I was the most disgusted I've ever been with anything in my life. So, and I'm not in favor of it. I mean, I'm not a grudge holder or anything like that, but I got a tremendous amount of respect for those guys that you mentioned that did the Plan B. I'll have to check that out. I don't think it'll change my opinion on them personally, but there'll be a little ounce of disappointment. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that. That was, I remember the fact that there was a lot of disappointment, just the fact of who it was and what they were doing.
So, Jerry, well, I guess we're about to run out. I got one last question for you. We're going to kind of wrap up with where you are presently. You know, you're still working with WWE, and you're a scout, basically, an amateur scout. I guess that's, I can call it that. Now, you may have a different name for it, or they may have a different name for it, but you travel the country looking at all these great young collegiate amateurs and seeing if they have the ability or the wants and the desires to get involved with professional wrestling. And I wonder, I have one question about it. How do you pitch that to them? No, but the business being what it is, how hard is that?
Okay, number one, I do call it a talent scout. Our office has that talent development, you know, but I figured myself, I've been very, very fortunate, Ron, in this business. I've had a lot of wonderful jobs, worked on a lot of different positions, been anywhere from booker to assistant booker to promoter to water boy to everything, you know, to main eventer to opening match. So I've been in a lot of different positions of, worked for a lot of great promoters, a lot of great people. But I feel like I have perhaps the greatest job that I've ever had in this business, getting to help these young men like I'm able to now. And people ask me what I look for and what's my cell job and everything. What I look for is just common sense. You know, number one, you walk into a arena and you look for big guys, and after you spot that big guy, your eyes get glued to him. You watch him as he walks around the arenas, and how he interacts with his teammates, how he interacts with the other competitors in his weight class. And then when he gets on the mat, you watch for his coordination. You watch it. Number one thing I watch is the footwork, because as Ron can tell you, footwork is the most important thing we do in our business. And so I watch your footwork. And I watch how they respond to a good call. I watch how they respond to a bad call. I watch how they respond to a win or a loss. So I watch everything. I just watch inside. And then if they pass the eye test, then I kind of get up with the coach and make friends with the coach and ask coach what kind of character they have. Because it's very important now in the corporate world that you bring guys in with good character. You bring guys in with good morals and values. And so that's very important to what I look for. And the standard of guys, a couple of guys I work for now, Kenyon Seaman and Paul Thayer. Paul ran IMG Academy over in Bradenton, Florida. That's one of the number one football academies in the entire United States. So he's got a great football contact. Kenyon Seaman was an all-world, I think, silver medalist in volleyball and a Stanford University graduate, and very keen on education and moral characters and everything. So they're two guys that I can bounce guys off of and get their opinion of. So it's quite a process that we go through, these amateur guys. But you know what? I'm straight up with them. You know, I go in and when I talk to them, I say, guys, I'm asking you for the entertainment business. I'm not asking you to continue to do what you're doing. We're entertainers. And I tell them about the business because that's a business I want them into, and they need to have knowledge about it. They kind of in the back of their mind because they've been shooting against other guys all their life, so they kind of can tune in the TV. And I'm not going to insult their intelligence and say, hey, man, we're all real and all that bullshit. I'm not going to do that to a young, educated man or any man, you know. We're what we are. We're entertainment now, and I'm proud of it. I think that it's grown. It's made it into a global business now. I think we have as much or more respect now in the off world as we've ever had, no matter how hard we tried to take care of it back in the old days. People know what they're dealing with now, and they know, but, you know, once that bell rings and the action goes, their beliefs are most of the time, if they're two talented guys out there, are suspended, and then, you know, they become fans again. And a lot of these guys I talk to, I was working with this kid from Duke University that we're working on getting finished or wrapping up. He's a Olympic candidate, and so we're hoping that, you know, that works out like it does for him. But we're working on, you know, getting him when it comes out. This guy's a Duke-educated man, and you're not going to tell him, hey, we're for real out there. We're battling each other. We're trying to hurt each other every night. You can't deal with that. You know, number one, I'm not going to be that guy that lies to these guys. I'm going to tell them the truth. They got a question, I'm going to answer the questions. I like to meet mom and dad and tell them, you know, hey, you know, as far as the drug scandals, you know, granted, back in the 70s and maybe 80s, there was a lot of that stuff, but there was a lot in society also. So you just can't point your finger at us. There were football players, basketball players, baseball players, everybody doing the juice. I said, but our drug testing now is as strict as any Division I or any Olympic or any major pro league system wellness policy out there. WWE's wellness policy is on that level. So you can rest assured that we're going to test your kids, and he's going to be competing against guys that are on the same playing field with him, not guys that are all jacked up because of PEDs and stuff like that. You got to be honest with these guys, and I feel like I've been very successful. I've brought in some of the most talented WWE superstars ever, and right now you can on Raw and SmackDown and see about close to a dozen of my guys on either show or on any given week. So they're working for us. WWE realizes there's a pool of guys out there. It's not a huge pool. Like I always rip Paul Thayer, who's a football guy. I said, you got thousands and thousands of guys and thousands of schools. I got 36, 40 some odd schools that have amateur wrestling in them. And I still, percentage-wise, probably bring in as much as anybody else in the company just on the small scale of guys that I have. Because I level with them, and I get guys who want to be in our business. A lot of fans, well, why are you out there recruiting? You know, this guy's been a fan. He's been in the business for X amount of years. And I said, well, for example, this Duke kid, he just had on Twitter a couple of days ago when he's 3 years old getting a Goldberg blanket. He said the greatest Christmas present he ever got in his life, and he's 3 years old. So this guy is not only a two-time All-American and a stud amateur wrestler, he was a fan since he was 3 years old. He got every action figure that WWE and WCW ever put out. So he was a fan. So I don't know where the fans are getting off. You know, why are you recruiting these guys that know nothing about a business when this guy's been a fan since his 3 years old, you know, basically. So you just got to be honest with them, tell them what our business is like. tell them the job opportunities that WWE has. I mean, you know, you can last a lifetime. If you've got skills in the WWE, Vince McMahon is smart enough, and Triple H is stepping into that role. They're bright enough to see that you have these other outside talents. And if you got a talent that's going to benefit this giant machine that Vince has created, they're going to find a spot for you. And then, you know, you can go from one position to another and never leave the company. I've been fortunate. 36 years now, I've been with WWE, WWF, / WWE. So there's places, you know, if you're motivated enough and have the incentive to do it and show the capability of doing something, they're going to find a spot for you. You know, if you're a good person, you got high moral character, and you're a good person, and you're 100% in. So I think I got the greatest job in the world, and I get to help young people who want help. And in today's climate society, you can't ask for any more anything more than that. And when I see one of these guys, I was very fortunate. Maybe you guys, I'm sure you have if you watch the program. At Heavy Equipment, those two young men there, Otis and Tucker, I got them both signed. I brought Tucker in. He was All-American at Arizona State University. And Otis, with Nico, he was a Pan-American gold medalist and All-American at Division II. But I found him out in Colorado Springs, somewhere like that. And I happened to be at the NXT at the PC when they got the call up, and watching these two guys get the news, hey, congratulations, you know, you just earned the next step. It was as exciting for me as it was for them. And I got the emotions like, hey man, it's me making that step up. You know, felt like I just won the world title. So it's rewarding to me to see these young men on TV, and really happy for me when I see them make progress like they're doing. And the coaches over there at NHC, they tell me, Risco, we love your guys because they're athletic and they're no maintenance guys, you know, because they've been disciplined all their life, and that wrestling mentality of dual, you know, workouts and study and training all their lives. So when they come, they're already a step ahead because of the background of the training of amateur wrestling gives them. So I'm proud of the amateur wrestlers that have come in. I'm proud of all these guys that I get to witness over NXT when they get that call up and get to go to the major leagues. And it's rewarding.
You know, Terry, they're really lucky. You know, they're lucky to have been discovered by somebody like you and somebody with the background you've got. And, you know, it's just you and your brother are two really unique guys that deserve all the credit that you earned. And you know, I really appreciate you being with me on this Super Studcast. It's been historical. You know, I think when fans listen to this, and hopefully they'll be listening to these type of things years and years down the road, I think you're being on here is giving people an idea of what wrestling was all about and how so many young guys that you and I, our age, that developed in the course of wrestling and the evolution of the sport. And it's just been a great honor and a great pleasure to have you on here, Jerry. You're just a remarkable person. And I wish you the very best in the future, my man, as always. And I can't wait to see you again. I want to show up over there at the restaurant, maybe the next meeting, and have a beer with you, man. And,
please do. You're always welcome. And back at you, my friend. I mean, we've known each other. We never really had the privilege of going up and down the road a lot, you know, together as I did with your brother. But the respect, you know, that I have for your family's history in this business is second to none. And I enjoy working with people, coming on these podcasts, people that are prepared and have the game plan, and you and Brian have a game plan and have things out. But you know what? We're going to have to get to that Jack Briscoe podcast and be nothing but Jack Briscoe. And hell with my role, you know. And I can be a proud little brother and be like I was in Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, just brag on my brother and say, okay, what you going to do now, bro?
Well, you know, we may do just that, Jerry. You know, I can't talk too much about your brother. He meant a lot to me. And
he was a unique person, just a very unique person, very giving person, and a And, you know, as you know, Ron, he's probably one of the most humble human beings that ever stepped in the ring. You know, I mean, there was no ego about Jack Briscoe. I mean, he was one and the same as everybody in the dressing room. You know, he never looked at himself as special, never looked at himself as the top guy or anything like that. He was always a giver and never a taker. And that's rare in our business, as you know. And I prefer to be around those givers. And you're one of them. I mean, your family. I mean, your dad, I mean, he was so kind. I mean, I had no reason to be. I was just a skinny little punk wrestler, you know, and a promoter in several different states. You know, when you work hard, you gain that respect. And that's something I always took pride in. My brother always told me and that take pride in that he did. Just work hard and that respect will come to you. So it's a labor of work, a labor of love. And, you know, we both have it. And I appreciate you guys' time that you've given me these last two shows. And hopefully we can get some audiences there.
Absolutely. And, you know, I might take you up on that, Jack. Just a real emphasis on Jack only. I would really love to do it because of what he meant to me. And thank you very much again, Jerry. Thank you so much. And I know fans around the world are, when they hear this one, they're going to really, really appreciate what you've given to the sport.
Well, thank you very much. I've been honored and privileged to do it. So there's more of it. I ain't over with yet, as they say.
There you go. Thank you very much.
Have a good day, guys. Thank you. Stay safe and stay healthy from this damn virus. And we're all in it together. And united they say we stand, as they say. Let's do it.
All right.
Thank you for being a patron and supporting all Studcast with your donation for this month's Super Studcast and the rest of the story. We're honored to bring these super events to our growing list of donors and appreciate your comments and feedback so we can continue to improve upon the 3 hours of unique and focused content we hope you've enjoyed. We encourage you to tell your friends about the Super Studcast and the rest of the story so the stud can continue to highlight the awesome history of his family and the sport we all love. So saddle up and ride the second and fourth Sunday of each month as we open the vault and spotlight wrestling history. This is David Summers thanking you on behalf of all the staff, including the great Brian Last and Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains. Another Super Studcast is done.